Former astronaut Story Musgrave will address the Mutual UFO Network crowd this weekend in California. He will delight them because he will tell them he believes we are not alone in the universe. But what he was also going to tell the Mutual UFO Network group, the largest UFO research organization in the world, by the way, is something they probably don't want to hear, that Earth has not been visited by extraterrestrials. That's his feeling. That's his interpretation. In a moment, we're going to be talking with Stephen Bassett. He heads up the X conference, and he'll be telling us his thoughts on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Stephen Bassett with us, leading advocate for ending the government-imposed truth embargo regarding an extraterrestrial presence engaging the human race. He's also the executive director of the Paradigm Research Group and also the Political Action Committee, the X-PAC, and the executive director of the X-Conference, a regular here on Coast to Coast. Here's Stephen Bassett. Stephen, good morning.
Good morning, George. It's great to be with you.
Good to have you, too. This story with Story Musgrave, former astronaut. On one hand, it's exciting that he believes we're not alone in the universe, but it's a little disappointing to hear that we've not been visited. There are a lot of people in the MUFON camp, Stephen, that just aren't happy with him being there as one of the keynote speakers. What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, I feel that everybody will arrive at their understanding about this phenomena in their own time and their own pace. And I've never been one to say, no, you got to get on board now, or you've got to force it. Everybody has got to get there in their own way. This is a big deal. This is not a trivial matter. And Story clearly has not gotten there yet. But the fact is that of the four astronauts who have spoken most to this subject in an open way and have engaged us, the researchers and the activists, are Gordon Cooper, of course, now deceased, Edgar Mitchell, Brian O'Leary, and Story Musgrave. So he deserves a lot of credit because he's not shy about coming to conferences. He's not shy about engaging the issue and talking publicly. So I think they should be more appreciative of the fact that he's getting a keynote at the symposium and is lending the tremendous prestige of being an astronaut to this issue. And eventually, Story will probably he'll learn more, and perhaps he will change his view. I have nothing but admiration for Story and all the astronauts that have talked about this.
It is exciting, Stephen, that he does believe we are not alone in the universe. I think that's pretty dramatic all by itself, though.
Well, Rasmussen just did a poll just recently, and we're talking within a couple of weeks. Now, the 58% of American people believe there's life on other planets, right? Which kind of implies almost intelligent life.
Yeah.
Generally, when they're asked, is there life somewhere else in the universe, you're getting a number up in the 85% range. Not too long ago, the Kepler scientists gave out their first, I guess you could say, galactic census. They had searched for enough planets and found enough that they can kind of extrapolate. And their first estimate was 50 billion planets in a galaxy, 500 million planets in the Earth zone or the Goldilocks zone. 500 million. I think we can assume that number will probably go up. And so, it won't be long. There won't be anybody that doesn't think not only is there not life elsewhere, but there's intelligent life elsewhere, which is one of the reasons why this whole issue is maturing now at warp speed.
When I was at your X conference a couple of years ago, I sat next to Edgar Mitchell at the banquet. Mm-hmm. And not only is he delightful, but I mean, he too is a staunch believer in extraterrestrial life, but also believes we've been visited. And, of course, I asked him, I said, come on now, tell me, what did you see on the moon? And he said, nothing unusual, other than things that were on the moon, but I didn't see any spacecraft or UFOs. I believe that. Do you?
Oh, I'm not going to dispute Edgar Mitchell's word, I can assure you. NASA has been stuck between a rock and a hard place since the day it was born in 1958 under the Space Act. I mean, the government knew very well their ETs at that point, and they still had to create a space agency because they had to go into a race with the Soviets. And they thought it would be awkward to create have a just military program, something like the Soviets had. So they created a civilian space agency, but they had a big problem. They're going to be flying around up there and they see things. What are they going to do about that? So when they created the act, there's a clause right in the front of the act that says that anything dealing with national security matters goes to the Department of Defense. Put that right in there, got it up front, so that NASA, no matter what happened, they could fly up orbiter around Mars and see a shopping mall down there. We weren't going to see a picture. We were not going to get told. It would be immediately turned over to the Department of Defense because the extraterrestrial issue is highest national security. So this is the way they had to tie NASA down. And so imagine poor NASA, from the day it's born, the most extraordinary thing that it could find or come to learn about absolutely was not theirs to control. It was a national security matter, and that has put them in a very tough spot. So what people know and can actually talk about, we really don't know. There have been a couple of people in NASA that have come forward and talked about some things while there, but overall, it's been pretty tight. So until we know the whole picture, I think there's no point in trying to second guess some of these top NASA people. They're all great people, particularly the astronaut corps, top of the line. And so they will say what they can say when they can say it. Edgar clearly has made it quite clear that it's not that he's a believer. He is convinced that the ET presence is real, and he's convinced that the Roswell crash was extraterrestrial based upon his, you know, PhD mind reasoning through what he has heard and seen. And that's true for, obviously, more people every day.
And Komarek, who's a UFO investigator, I'm pretty sure you know him, has written a blog, and he is questioning MUFON's decision to promote Musgrave as its featured speaker at the symposium, and he said it's a slap in the face to the membership. Do you agree with that?
It's not. Yeah, I would have to respectfully disagree. One of the things we have to do, it's not easy. The UFO issue was ghettoized from the, you know, from the very beginning. There was a truth embargo put in place. The government is harassed, hounded, misinformed, undermined. They've really made it tough for a lot of people. And so there's a lot of anger, there's a lot of frustration, and I understand that. And you want to kind of dish it back. I've had my moments where I have dished it back and regretted it. What we need to do is to start bridging into the larger world, the larger organizations, the mainstream world, mainstream people, and not pick fights, really. And I know that's hard to do sometimes. Almost all of PRG's work is about trying to build these bridges so that not only can we cross over there, they can come over and hang out with us. And this is happening, and I'll tell you more about that tonight. There's a lot of this kind of stuff going on. So I think they should view Story being there as a bridge, and you treat him well, because there's a lot of other astronauts, yeah, and you never know who's going to turn up tomorrow.
I agree with that, Stephen. And also, tell me about this World Disclosure Day that the Paradigm Research Group has set up.
Oh, yeah. I'm so happy about this, George. I was on I was being interviewed in late June for about an hour by a reporter from the Financial Times of London. He called to talk about World UFO Day, which was July the 2nd, which I sort of knew about, but I really hadn't followed it. About halfway through this interview, I'm going, wait a minute. What we need is a World Disclosure Day, right? And so where have I been on that? And so as soon as we hung up with him, I went on the line, and I discovered that there really wasn't one, though. Last August, a blogger, activist blogger named Steve Becko, tried to kind of get it going, you know, kind of put it out there. I think Jeffrey West also worked it out with him, but it didn't catch. You know how it is? I mean, the internet is, and the web is kind of an interesting instrument. There's certain resonance frequencies, and if you can hit the right tone, boom, you go viral, right? So it didn't take, and I said, okay, let me take a shot at this. And so I launched the World Disclosure Day on July 1. The websites were up. The Facebook presence was up. International press release was out. I mean, this is what I do best. So I said, hey.
And you've done that way for years. You're as good as they come when it comes to that.
And so within 2 days, we had 2,000 endorsements, right? It had come in at the site at worlddisclosureday.org.
Yep.
Now we're up to almost 4,000 endorsements. And there is no limit. I mean, anyone can go and they can endorse World Disclosure Day, which is essentially a day designated to focus attention on this truth embargo and the need for the governments to, or the world, to tell their citizens the truth about this matter. It's not complicated. It's not a petition. So there is no limit. I mean, it could go to 100,000, a million, 2 million, and you've got millions in your audience. If even a couple hundred thousand were to go to worlddisclosureday.org and simply put their endorsement in, it's an email form. It's very simple. Very sure we can load it up in 2 days.
Sure.
A couple hundred thousand. Now that you can imagine that heft that represents, you see, that I can use to go to the media and point in that direction and say, see what's going on here. Plus, we also have organizational endorsements, and then we have a section of notable endorsements, you know, people of note as they start to develop, and we're trying to develop more of that so we can kind of highlight that. And so essentially what we have is we have this building presence of people calling for disclosure. And the cool thing is it makes it really easy for people that are not part of our world, but like this issue, to put their name in, throw their organization in the ring, without, you know, being too uncomfortable, because it's a very straightforward thing. It's not complicated. It's basically a truth process. And one of the cool things, George, is that after about 3,500 of the endorsements came in, I happened to notice that a fourth of them, 800 plus, were coming from mainland China.
Really?
This really struck me. So these things are pouring in from mainland China. Most of the people couldn't speak English, but they're filling out the form. And I'm able to get, in most cases, the basic information. All that's put up is a first and last name, city, state, or city, country. No email addresses are posted. And these forms allow you to leave comments. And so I'm reading the comments from these people in China. And boy, am I getting a powerful sense of yearning, a powerful sense that they really see something happening, and they see that as opening up a new world. And as you know, China has not restricted UFO research. It actually encourages it. There's a lot of groups in China. Sightings are starting to be reported.
It's one of the strange things that they don't restrict. You know, they don't want you to talk about time travel. They don't want to talk about reincarnation. They're outlawing that. But with UFOs, Katie barred the door, isn't it?
Well, it's strange unless you're looking at the picture the way I see it. I mean, if China, which is a leading candidate to disclose, I mean, they definitely now are up near the top of the list, is thinking they may make that move and be the disclosure nation, then it would be kind of awkward if they're suppressing that. And it's generally nonpartisan, but it is notable that they are not. And so, my Lord, if this thing goes viral in China, can you imagine?
Could be huge.
So World Disclosure Day is off and running, the goal is to get to 100,000 endorsements, to get a number of notable endorsements up there, and then we'll work from that to plan. People will plan. I'm already getting videos people are creating. We'll hopefully people come up with ideas for events for next year. But here's the kicker. The way this is set up is simple. If disclosure takes place at any time, September 20, January 15th. The moment that happens, World Disclosure Day will be immediately changed to that date.
Sure.
And it will go forward as that date. And I think World Disclosure Day will be even more important in the post-disclosure world. So we've kind of got this in place and got it going, and I'm just really happy about it.
You and I together have been at this for about 14 years.
Yes.
Think you're now convinced that if disclosure comes, it's going to come from another country. Is that pretty good assumption on my part?
I think I'm now about 50-50, right? I mean, we are in a disclosure race, and that's one of the reasons why it's almost over, barring the awful event, right? This is the thing that we can talk about this later, but this is the thing I'm most worried about, the awful event that puts everything on hold, right?
Sweeps
everything off the
table. And we saw this happen once before, didn't we?
Oh, well, yeah, but I'm talking about many times bigger than that, many times bigger than 911. So we need to get this done. It's a race. Now, you know what happens when we get in these races. We got in an arms race with the Soviet Union. I think we eventually end up with 30,000 nuclear weapons,
yeah.
And they had 40.
Yeah.
We got in a space race, announced it, went to the moon in 8 years. So starting around 2000, when the French broke ranks with the truth embargo and released a committee report and then later started releasing their files, and all these other countries have come on board, it's now clear that we're in a race. It's a question of who's going to make the move first. And there's a lot of geopolitical dynamics here. Lord knows all the calculations that are going into this. And it may be that ultimately the U.S. still goes first. However, I don't think anyone would think we're in a world right now where the U.S. could demand, require that it be first and everybody else would have to acquiesce. That ship has sailed. So at this point now, with the race underway, I mean, any day, whatever the problems you see in the U.S. for disclosure, and if people give them to me, oh, because of this and that and everything else, I say, well, fine. France doesn't care. China doesn't care.
Brazil doesn't care.
Still doesn't care. So, again, with any luck, I'll be switching the date on World Disclosure Day anytime now.
Are you going to be in England for that event in Leeds, England?
As a matter of fact, I am. As you know, the presidential election campaign is already underway, so I thought it was a good time to flee over the ocean. And I'll be heading out on the 2nd for the Leeds Exopolitics Conference, August 5 through 7. And I will be staying for 7 weeks.
Wow.
Hopefully doing some, yeah. So I have a lot of contacts over there. Exopolitics is thriving in the UK thanks to the work of David Griffin of Exopolitics United Kingdom and Anthony Beckett. There have been 3 Leeds conferences, there have been some other conferences. It's really taking off. So I really get a lot of valuable time there. I may do some informal chats if people host me either in the UK or maybe on the other side of the channel. And I'm also going to try to get most of the book that I have to write done so that I can get it out by the end of the year.
Good.
As soon as I know I can announce that, I'll let you know.
Okay, very good. Did you go to the Emirates at all? I know Friedman did.
No, I was not. I was green with envy, but no, I did not go. That was a major disclosure indicator, by the way. And later I could talk about some of these other indicators. But yeah, when one of the members of the royal family, Abdulaziz, hosts the what was then, I think, the 4th Global Competitiveness Forum, decides that they're going to have a panel on contact and extraterrestrials. That isn't for casual entertainment. Those people paid $4,000 to be at that conference.
They sure did.
Their first-class airfares probably cost $10,000.
Yeah.
And so this was Saudi Arabia basically, frankly, throwing its hat in the disclosure ring, sort of letting people know, yeah, we know what's going on.
Isn't that weird for them to do that?
No. Recently, I don't know if you know this, but recently the Saudis made some significant announcements regarding alternative energy. They want to kind of get ahead of the game. Look, the Saudis fully know that disclosure, the ET issue, is very soon, very likely going to reduce the value of that oil under their feet substantially.
Right.
And they're not idiots. And so they have lots of money, and I think it behooves them to get on the right side of the issue, be prepared to invest their money in alternative energies and elsewhere, and they'll be fine. But a lot of people don't like them because they're charging more and more for that oil, and every time the price goes up, people suffer. Trust me, it's not just about an extra 20 cents on your gas tank or per gallon of gas. I mean, people in the third world really suffer when energy goes up. So they're not well liked in a lot of ways. They're kind of looked as somewhat villainous. But I'm sure that they would like to change that. And being, standing in the way of disclosure, if it appears that they are deliberately trying to affect the disclosure process rather than get on board, it's going to look very bad for them. Meaning you're going to withhold reality so you can sell more oil. So this is a significant event. Stan Friedman did a fantastic job, as did Nick Pope. Jacques Vallée was there, and I believe all of those presentations are on the internet, and you can go see them.
Sure. Heavy hitters down there. There was a Saudi prince running around Beverly Hills this weekend with his entourage, and you're right. I think they know, even though I believe in the abiotic oil theory, which means this planet has an abundance of it, mm-hmm. If we had an alternative energy source, you'd be talking about $5 a barrel for oil.
But remember, it's not just cost. If we don't get alternative energy in play, if that ET energy, which I believe they've spent a hell of a lot of money and time on, is not brought out for either immediate implementation or further development by the world's intellectual resources, remember, regardless of the price of this stuff, we're breathing it. Coal, oil, bunker fuel is killing millions of people every year because of pollution.
Yeah.
And gasoline additives, you don't even want to go there, right? You'll be up all night. And so it's not just about money. It's about people's lives and the quality of life.
If they care about that, Stephen. I'm not sure they do.
But the people do,
yeah.
And we outnumber them. And we have the internet, and we've got coast to coast, and we've got tremendous power. You'd be amazed what we could do when we really finally get cranking.
Stay with us. Stephen Bassett, our special guest. When we come back, we'll get his take on Annie Jacobson's book on Area 51. And also Roswell as well, the theory that the Soviets sent some kind of craft over here to us. So we'll find out all about that and get Stephen's reaction. Then we'll also talk about his biggest fear, the awful event. Next hour, we'll take your phone calls with him as well. I'm George Norrie, back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM. With our special guest tonight, Stephen Bassett, and we're going to take phone calls next hour with Stephen as we talk about the Disclosure Project. That's all next on Coast to Coast AM. We've had some guests on, Stephen, that have commented on Annie Jacobson's work on Area 51, her discussions about the Soviets sending a craft here, and that was Roswell. What's your take on that?
Yeah, Annie Jacobson wrote a perfectly reasonable book about Area 51. Not too many books have been done, so she gets credit for that. But she decided to throw in a last chapter, not too many pages, in which she, based on the single input from an octogenarian former engineer at Area 51, a story that Roswell was a conspiracy between Joseph Mengele and Joseph Stalin, the two Josephs, and using some, I think, deformed or malformed 13-year-olds to fly this thing over the United States in order to scare the hell out of it. And my take is this. First of all, that chapter would have been no less ridiculous if she had written a chapter about the fact that the reason that we were surprised at Pearl Harbor was because President Roosevelt was having a love affair with Tojo. I would have been just as ridiculous. My take was this. There's no way that ridiculous chapter, which sounded like a script pitch for a movie to Sony Pictures or something, is even in that book if it weren't for the truth embargo. In other words, Annie Jacobson, because of the truth embargo, which has sort of created this scenario where, you know, this is clearly not something you go, the government denies it, the major papers tend to avoid it, so there's really nothing there. So she didn't feel compelled to maybe read the top 5, 6, 7 books on Roswell by researchers that studied it for decades. She just throws this out there. Of course, she's going to come to regret this. I will say this. I reviewed all the media, and 80%, 90% of all of the media that was about this book, the headlines were about the Roswell chapter. So maybe it was just to sell books. But again, without the truth embargo, she would never have done that because it looks ridiculous. Right. So it's a perfect example of how when the government plays with us and plays with reality, it creates these weird situations where this can happen. I don't think she's a bad person, but she's, you know, basically a victim of the truth embargo, like all of us are in one form or fashion.
How do you know they're not plants, Stephen, to misinformation people?
It could have been. It could have been. It also could have been a disinformation plant to kind of mess with the issue, though it doesn't really make sense. It could have been a joke on the part of these Area 51 people. Because not all of them were thrilled about this book. It's hard to say. Something else that was good about it, George, within hours after this thing really hits the internet, the guys and the girls were on it, the researchers were on it, and they were already ripping it up pretty bad. And this is the great thing about the net now. And notably, Nightline really took her to task over that ridiculous chapter. And remember, that chapter was not asserting that extraterrestrials were at Roswell, but rather it was this wild conspiracy. And Nightline just took her apart. So I saw that as also an indication of this really is a different arena now. And writers out there need to be advised. This is not 1975. If you want to play around, you're going to take a hit.
And juxtapose that with someone like Leslie Keene, who writes a book on pilots and generals and government officials who go on the record to talk about UFOs, a very aggressive, positive story about what's out there.
Sure. And that kind of brings me to some of the disclosure indicators. Could I maybe go into that now?
Sure.
My job is to kind of watch everything that's going on as much as possible and look for indicators, look for things which I see are relevant to disclosure and maybe even revealing. And one of the things I've noted is that both the Colbert Report and the Daily Show, Jon Stewart, are starting to engage this issue. You know, we lost Larry King, bless his heart. And I don't see Piers Morgan going
from the show, at least.
You're right. Don't
say that tonight, Stephen. It'll be all over the internet.
He's alive and kicking. Yeah. He's probably working on his ninth wife. So it's like Daily Show and the Colbert have taken it up. Daily Show had Leslie Kane on. Colbert had Leslie Kane on. She did very well. The Daily Show has interviewed Clifford Cliff of MUFON. That interview may turn up. I think they had somebody else on. And I've had a number of chats with the producers of both shows. Now, what's important is these two shows, let me tell you, have huge cachet with young people, 18 to 28. I mean, they worship these shows. And so if these shows start bringing this issue out with more people coming on, it's going to be very significant. And I noted that. But there's other things going on. There were two things that I expected that needed to happen before disclosure took place, or should likely happen before disclosure
took place. And what would that be?
One of them, defunding or suspension of SETI, which, as you know, has taken place.
Yes.
And this is non-trivial. Paul Allen has put millions and millions and millions of dollars into that. A lot of it went to build the Allen Array telescopes, radio telescopes. And now, no more funding. Allen apparently pulled the plug. Why is this important? It's public relations.
Mm-hmm.
You see, the government has got a number of public relations problems they're going to have to deal with right after disclosure, and it's unavoidable. One of the first questions they'll get asked is, well, if you knew about ETs going all the way back to the 40s, what's with SETI, right? And they're basically going to have to explain that, well, no, we had to create SETI because if we weren't doing something to look for ETs, if we weren't making some effort, it would look awkward. So we want to take pressure off of us so we can maneuver. And SETI is put out there as basically a front operation. It's a whether the people in it knew this doesn't matter. It's a propaganda front in order to take pressure off the government. Always has been from the day it was formed. Now, if you're going to have to answer that question, it's going to be a lot more awkward if SETI is fully operating up the road. But if it's either shut down or in suspension, then it's kind of in the past. You know what I'm saying?
That's right.
It's like, yeah, but you know, it's over now. So that's happened. And then another one, probably even more important. The shuttle program is over.
It's done.
All right. Why is that significant? Not too long after disclosure takes place. You know, that's where, you know what that means. The formal announcement takes about 5 minutes of the ET presence, confirmation by state, the heads of state.
And maybe it's done by generals. Who knows?
Or whatever.
Yeah.
Right. But it's the real deal. There's no ambiguity here. One of the questions they're going to get asked is, what about that technology? Wait a minute. What about the anti-gravitic craft we've been saying? Do we have anti-gravitic craft? Yes, we do. And when did we have them? Well, we had them back in the house. And then the next question, here's the killer. If we had anti-gravitic craft capable of taking people in orbit, what do you have to say to the families of the 14 astronauts that mm-hmm. died on that weird million-part, very dangerous shuttle
That's right.
that we've been sending?
And what was the propulsion system like, and why aren't we using it today?
And that's a tough one. And so if you have to answer that question, you don't want to have another shuttle sitting out there on the launch pad ready to go up a few weeks. You want the shuttle program over, and so that you can say, look, we're sorry. That's what we have to say. We're sorry. You're going to write some big checks to those families.
You know what they'll say, Stephen? We hadn't perfected it all yet.
What? Well, they could do that, but if they lie, I mean, you know, every syllable that comes out of their mouth post-disclosure is going to be examined.
We know they lie.
And if they lie, that they're going to get hurt. So, again, it's public relations. If the shuttle program is over, at least you can say it's over. And then the big one, George, and I predict this may be the next major development in the disclosure process, and it is the emergence of the what we'll call notable contactees. It is inevitable, and it's starting. And what I mean by that is I can assure you, based on the numbers that we have sussed from various polls that have been done and so forth. I mean, it's a rough number, but it's a big number. There are, and I already know this, there are notable people in Hollywood that are contactees. There are notable people in the music industry that are contactees, in the sports, you know, the big-time sports that are contactees, as well as significant political and even military figures. And so what is going to happen, I think, soon is they're going to start coming out. We're seeing the very early stages of that. Robbie Williams publicly engages the issue. Peter Andre has now come out on the issue and is and talking to Robbie, and that's all in the news. Sammy Hagar, who's, you know, 64 now, by the way, he's born a couple of months after Roswell, but he was huge at one time, mm-hmm. has come forward in his book and said he thinks he's a contactee. So what I'm saying is, at any moment, tomorrow, the next day, somebody quite extraordinary is going to go in either in a book or a memoir, an interview, and they're going to say, you know, couldn't talk before now, but I need to tell you, I've been dealing with these entities since I was 3, 4, 5 years old. This is going to have huge impact. And once it starts, it could steamroll. So this is a major factor, and this is one of the reasons why I put a lot of support behind a book that came out just recently by a contactee named Kim Carlsberg called The Art of Close Encounters. And the reason that, you know, I don't do this, really, this is the first time I've ever done this, the reason I really got behind this book and worked very hard to get it out was it's a unique book. It's 150 accounts of contact in synopsis form with art associated with each one, and a lot of the art is done by the contactee. It's an absolutely amazing book, and it's so accessible. It's the kind of thing that anybody, because remember, there are people out there, contactees, they don't even know what UFOs are.
And the artwork is amazing.
The artwork is amazing. Anybody can go into this book and get a sense of it. It's not threatening. If you're a contactee, you can use it to kind of show people, this is what may be happening to me. So I saw this book as a significant bridge to the mainstream public. And so for that reason, I've gotten behind it. It's available at theartofcloseencounters.com, theartofcloseencounters.com. And I hope we'll see more books like that. But right now, it's the only one of its kind. And again, contactees are about to make their move. Just trust me on this, George. I talk to a lot of them. I've been, you know, doing some back behind-the-scenes stuff, and I smell it coming. Now, I'm not saying that people should just all come out. You don't come out on this, out of the closet on this, unless you feel you can do it. And if you don't feel you can do it, don't do it. But I sense that a lot of people are right there, and they're going to step out, and some of them are going to be pretty well known. And that is going to change the equations.
Stephen, what drives you? You don't stop. You have had more energy with this UFO issue since the beginning when I first met you a long time ago.
Oh, George, you mix an excessive compulsive personality with an inability to hold down a regular job. You throw in, well, and then you throw in the issue, which is pretty darn compelling. And you can easily end up like this. But, you know, a lot of the people in this field are this way. I mean, you look at Stan Friedman and so many of the other researchers, Linda Moulton Howe, some of them, they've been at it for 40, 45 years. Look, it is the biggest issue of our time or any time. If you can get in it and you can play a role, if you can find some funding and play a bigger role, all the better. But whatever, it's really powerful. And when you are able to have some impact, and I feel that I have, and PRG has had some impact, it's almost impossible to think, oh, I'll stop doing this and I'll go and do something else. So as far as me, look, I'm in a advocacy mode on this. I mean, it's not like I'm just looking for lights in the sky. There are very strong reasons why this advocacy is important, and I'll tell you, I'll condense it down into like the key point, which I've really been hammering lately a lot. It's a tricky point. It's a complicated point, and it's hard for some people to grasp it, which is why I think it's been extremely difficult to get funding for this issue. But it goes like this. As I've said many, many times, disclosure is inevitable and soon, but will it be soon enough?
Right.
And so the point is, look, if it's inevitable, hey, let's relax. Take it easy. It's going to happen, okay? No sense of getting worked up in a sweat about this.
When it evolves, right?
But no, here's the problem. It has to do between the difference between the pre-disclosure world and the post-disclosure world and the problems we're facing right now. And the easiest way that I can make this point, it's a little macabre, but it's serious, is this. Bad things are going to happen. You can count on it. They're already happening, right? We know about bad things.
Sure.
Well, there's more bad things that can happen and probably will, all right? And however bad they are, it's really how we react to them that is going to determine how things go, not necessarily the event. Perfect example. A couple of Czechs got together and decided to assassinate the Archduke Ferdinand and his wife. Okay, terrible thing, but frankly, Europe, the rest of the world could pretty much have moved on without them. It wasn't a huge loss. The reaction to that assassination, along with other things, triggered a catastrophe, World War I, a disaster. Right? And which set the stage for World War II, which set the stage for World War III. So it's how we react. And so let's take the situation regarding a nuke event, which is the big one. It's the one that people behind the scenes in Washington are talking about forever. They don't go out public about it, but this is what's on their mind all the time. The day after.
Of a city, no doubt.
Of Washington. The day after July the 4th. The Discovery International Channel ran a documentary called The Day After Disaster. It originally came out in 2009, had a short run on the History Channel. They brought it back to life, ran it several times. This documentary is 2 hours long, was made with the full cooperation of Department of Homeland Security.
Right.
What's it about?
Frightening.
It's about a nuclear bomb going off in Washington, D.C.
A suitcase type, wasn't it?
Yeah, I think it was about a 4 or 5 kiloton. And it talks, and this movie is basically a message to the people. The politicians can't talk about this. Generally, we can't talk about it, but you need to know something, and here it is. And it makes the point that it will be awful. And we're not just sort of talking about the event itself, which will be bad, but it's the aftermath. It is the consequences that will be bad. And I can, and whether it's a nuclear event in Washington or Tel Aviv or Medina or London, if it happens, and believe me, the insiders are just waiting. To them, it's inevitable, right? If it happens.
Could be 20 years from now, 50 years.
It could be tomorrow.
Yeah.
But it's critical that if it does happen, it happens in the post-disclosure world. In other words, the difference between pre- and post-disclosure world could mean everything. Because in the post-disclosure world, we will be in a different place, in a different mindset, in a different worldview, with a whole different set of priorities. And it may be that we can absorb it and not end up creating a conflagration that would take us down in the darkness for 20, 30 years and put off disclosure even longer. And in that 20 years, God knows what else happens. That's why this advocacy has got to go forward, and it's got to, and disclosure's got to come as quickly as possible, so that whatever we're about to face, whatever calamity history's got in store for us, it will have to happen after disclosure. And in this documentary, they make this point, believe it or not, if you get it, you'll see it. The documentary basically makes the point that it doesn't matter who takes credit for that nuclear destruction of Washington. The response will be draconian because it will be viewed as an opportunity. Right? You get my point?
I do.
This is Department of Homeland Security saying this, an opportunity, my God, to do what? And so this advocacy is far more important than people, I think, fully realize. When they grasp this concept of the pre-disclosure world, the post-disclosure world, and the things that we're going to have to face. And I also make the point that disclosure is so powerful and so changing that it might have the power to prevent that event from happening, that it may set in motion a series of circumstances that result in that event not taking place. I think it's much more likely than it would actually make it more likely. And so we have enormous potential benefits, but we've got to get disclosure done now. We do not have the luxury of sitting back and simply waiting for it to be delivered to us.
No, we can't do it. We can't do it at all, Stephen. And Stephen, one of his books, by the way, U.S. Presidents and UFOs, The Untold Story. His websites, they're all linked up for you at coasttocoastam.com. And I have known Stephen since 1977. So we're talking about 14 years. I have interviewed him about the Disclosure Project, and he and I differ about this. Originally, he thought governments would come right out and disclose. And he thought that was going to happen 14 years ago. As a matter of fact, he was working on a campaign where he was going to have all these government whistleblowers sign a letter that was going to be published in the Washington Post. And it never happened. He was never able to get those people to all sign this letter and do what he did. But he is driven, and he keeps going with it. And he's simply not going to stop. Next hour, we'll take some phone calls with Stephen Bassett for you here on Coast to Coast AM. And fire away. If you need to email me, that's george@coasttocoastam.com. Though I will take your phone calls about your own specific UFO cases. I'd like you primarily also to address a question to Stephen as well about what he's been working on in his disclosure project. And as he said, he's going to England in less than a few weeks to talk at a major conference there, because worldwide they are all interested in that. I'm looking forward. Can you call in from England with a little report for Stephen when you're out there?
Absolutely. Happy to do it.
Okay. Well, good. Stand by. We'll take some phone calls with you in a moment on Coast to Coast AM with Stephen Bassett, our special guest tonight. Our phone numbers? Well, we'll have Ross give you those numbers in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM.